I'm Kim, and welcome to Esoteric's podcast, You Can't Eat the Sunshine, for the week of April 4, 2016. Join us this week as we talk with Roger Evan Kislingbury, Pasadena impresario and Old West aficionado, about his new book, American Saloons, Pre-Prohibition Photographs. We'll also talk with Gail Finney, co-curator at the Palos Verdes Art Center, about their brand new show, Palos Verdes Modern, a retrospective of mid-century modern design on the peninsula. So stay tuned.
You can't eat the sunshine, but you can make a beeline for the best of the coastline. La 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 la. Skid Row, Solano Canyon, the Doria, and Pico Union, the long-lost neighborhood called Hermina between South Pass and Highland Park, Grand Central Park. It is divine. You can't eat the sunshine, but it's a gold mine.
Welcome, everyone. Thank you for listening to our podcast, You Can't Eat the Sunshine, for the week of April 4th, 2016. This episode will have interviews with Roger Evan Kislingbury, a.k.a. Waldo. He is a Pasadena impresario. He is a restaurateur. He is one of my favorite people in the world. He's a treasure and a great asset to Pasadena. And he's also author of a new book. The new book is called American Saloons, Pre-Prohibition Photographs. This is a follow-up to his book of about 15 years ago, Bars, Saloons, and Cigar Shops, which is now out of print. I built a Shopify site for him where you can buy his book. So we want you to buy his book. It's a great book. Our second guest today, Gail Finney. Gail Finney is a co-curator at the Palos Verdes Art Center. We interviewed her at opening night for their new show, Palos Verdes Modern, which is a show about mid-century modern architecture and design on the peninsula. And this is just going to be great. So, Kim, you're the Pishka Maven. One, say hello to everyone, and two, remind us about the Pishka.
Hello, everyone, and here we are back again now on our new monthly schedule, and I am here to tell you that if you dig the show and you like what we do and you'd like to be supportive, it is possible to do so by putting a little something into our digital tip jar. It's, of course, never obligatory, but it's much appreciated. The support of our listeners helps keep the Chili Rano burritos flowing and tea in the thermos and generally makes us feel loved. So your support, much appreciated by Richard and myself. Thank you.
So there's this film. It's based on a German novel called Night of the Generals. It stars Peter O'Toole, and it's about Hitler's generals in Western Europe. And they all get to Paris. They've, like, burned the ghetto in Warsaw. Peter O'Toole's the sociopath general that burns the ghetto. And they're like, in Paris, and his valet, like, he gets out of uniform for a day for some reason. It's, like, part of the plot. Forget why, but his valet, like, has to. Valet can't be with him, so his valet gives his backup valet two thermoses of black coffee and a fifth of whiskey, and says, and it's like 8 o'clock in the morning, and they're sending him into occupied Paris for the day to sightsee, right? In this really beautiful double-breasted suit and this perfect Homburg, and the valet says, okay, this should keep until about two. If you have any questions, just call the field office. And that's when you talk about the Pishka, that's what I think about. That should keep him till two. Okay, so it's a great film.
Just call me your backup valet.
No, it's part of the plot why he has a backup. It's really great. Okay, so Kim, it's time to talk about Closely Watched Trains. I'm happy to say that after doing this for many years, I think we finally achieved a large degree of self-actualization in that. Finally, the goal of the Closely Watched Trains when we started this years ago was that the majority of links would be
links on our website, things that we're getting the word out about. And yeah, it looks like we're kind of getting there.
Yeah. So that was really when I conceived of Closely Watched Trains on this podcast 3 years ago, 4 years ago. It was that most of the links would be esoteric blog posts, lava of blog. Yeah. So we're making it happen. So thank you, Kim. Okay. So Kim, just really quickly, first Closely Watched Train. The Claude Biellemin 1928 structure, Foreman and Clark's department store, 6th and Hill. Thank you, 7th and Hill. Thank you, 7th and Hill. It's the northwest corner. I think our southwest. Thank you. Gothic, Art Deco Gothic. This is a gorgeous Foreman and Clark's department store. Famous, their famous motto, chain, national chain, their motto was, our shop's on the second floor, so you pay less. Because they would build these buildings and then rent out the ground floor to other, to tenants. So this is the heart of the jewelry district. The jewelry district is a huge economic engine, something we're reminded of by passengers every time we give a downtown tour, and we're standing at the corner of 7th and Broadway. But, Kim, this is a real paradigm, it is a paradigm shift because everyone's been removed.
Yeah, the last owner, it's just changed hands. The last owner picked it up in 2012, and his intention was to turn it into a hotel, but it's really hard to make deals with these hipster hoteliers these days, and so nothing happened, but everyone got evicted. And the new owner, who's picked it up, intends to turn it into residential mixed use. So it is interesting because, as you say, the jewelry district remains a powerful economic force, and yet it's becoming harder and harder for people to hold on to their spaces. And I wonder if the jewelry district will consolidate into a tighter footprint in downtown Los Angeles, or if it might move away. Obviously, there's a huge jewelry industry in Arizona with all of the gem fairs. So I think it's something we should be thinking about, and I'll be curious to see how things move in the next couple of years.
I think the jewelry district is fine. I wish that our friend Levon, God rest his soul, was still around for us to have a cup of espresso with and ask him questions like this, because Levon really was one of these guys that helped create the jewelry district. I think we're going to see. We bought our wedding rings in the jewelry district. So
they just gutted that building.
Yeah, I know. Okay, so Kim, the next closely watched train on the list is Bob Baker, and that's you.
Yeah, everyone's talking about the Bob Baker Marionette Theater because the long-threatened redevelopment of this historic cultural landmark on the south end of Echo Park is now approaching, and because it is a landmarked building, a cultural resource, rather nondescript building, but it is where Bob Baker had his puppet theater for nigh on 50 years, and Bob died a couple of years ago, but the theater is landmarked, and the developer who owns it has this idea that he can build over 100 apartments on the site, and the parking lot next door, and the warehouse next door, so it's a sprawling site. There at First and Beverly, is that correct, Richard?
Yeah.
First and Beverly, next to that weird bridge that's only a traffic bridge. And call it Marionette Lofts and use some of the theater space as a lobby and put up some pictures of oldie-timey puppets and kind of get around the notion of maintaining the historic landmark in that way. And what a lot of people who work at the theater and who love the theater, patrons and participants and landmarking people say is that, well, why can't this developer make a true mixed-use space, maintain the puppet theater in its functional fashion, because there should be retail on the ground floor, some sort of retail or some sort of business space, and have apartments above? Why does the theater have to be completely destroyed? And so over, at last count, and I'm sure it's quite a bit more than that now, over 700 people have contacted the city and said that's what they would like to see happen. And now it's simply a matter of what's going to be determined as the appropriate path for this developer who's seeking variances to take. I think it can still be a profitable building. It was purchased very inexpensively because it's a landmark, which creates some limits into what you can do on it. And everybody would really like to see the Bob Baker Theater survive. Obviously, they could move. They're doing quite well now. They've never done better. But if they moved, it wouldn't really be the same. It wouldn't be Bob's space, and it wouldn't be this great part of that rather nondescript, offbeat part of Southern Echo Park. So fingers crossed. Please go to the link on our website, which is on this podcast page, if you'd like to send a letter or get some more information about this, and we'll keep you posted. Our fingers are crossed real tight. We loved Bob, and the theater is an extraordinary time capsule of entertainment for children of all ages, and it really deserves to be preserved and allowed to grow into the next century.
I have a really good idea, Kim. People should just go, and when they see Eric Garcetti with his family there, tell him to make the Planning Commission, you know, positively impact the EIR to save the theater.
Exactly.
Okay, Kim. About a year ago, we did about 16 months ago, we did a podcast with our good friend, Dr. Ivers, Louise Ivers. She's the Long Beach history maven, and she'll be co-hosting my birthday bus tour this year with me. It will be Long Beach. We did a really nice interview with her and with Brian Kaiser about this mural at the Port Building, which has been approved for demolition. It's been vacant for a couple of years, and they want to demolish it. But this is a really important tile mural, and when we did the interview, the understanding was that they were going to move the mural. And now the understanding is they don't want to move the mural. So I'm glad the birthday bus is going there, because this will bring lots of focus.
Well, I don't know. The last time we were there, it didn't take long before a port police officer came over and asked us what we were up to.
But on the birthday bus, the port police are going to escort us in.
Oh. That'd be nice. Well, the officer was pretty nice once we told him.
He wasn't nice.
He was nice to me.
Then I went back the other time.
Oh.
Yeah. But the port police will escort us in for the birthday bus. Yeah.
I'm nodding.
Okay. Good. So we're going to keep an eye on that. I don't know. I want Brian Kaiser to salvage it. But we'll see.
Well, I mean, that's the interesting thing, is the port is saying, well, we don't know how much it's going to cost. I mean, it could be $1 million. Well, no, just ask Brian what it's going to cost. That's what he does for a living. It's a large mural, but of course it can be taken down and it can be moved. And why not?
See our podcasts with Brian and his work at the Lafayette Hotel about saving old tile murals in Long Beach. There's a great track record for that. So maybe the Navy can come back and help. Okay, so Kim, we got to keep moving here. Bungalow Courts on Edinburgh. Go.
Okay, well, this was kind of exciting. So there's this fabulous bungalow court just west of Fairfax, not too far from Fairfax High School. And it's just delightful. It's got this overarching frame and bungalows on both sides, a perfect early 1920s Hollywood, low to middle income residence. And purchased, it's the same story we always tell, purchased by a developer wanting to take advantage of the city's new law allowing these small lot developments, which are just an absolute bane of the preservationist's existence and pretty hard on neighborhoods too, because where you had one house on a fairly decent sized lot, or in this case, multiple bungalows with I think like 15 to 20 people living there, you'll knock the whole thing down and put up all of these tiny little townhouses that normally zoning wouldn't permit, but it's incredibly profitable. That's the problem. These developers, they're smallish developers, and they just come in, they buy a house that's worth $700,000 for $900,000, so nobody who wants to live in it can compete, and then they knock down this $900,000 house, and they make a $2 million profit, and the neighborhood has to live with what they've built. This isn't really dealing with the issues of, you know, low-income housing scarcity in the city, and in many cases, it means that kind of interesting historic structures are on the chopping block. But in this case, the people who lived in these bungalow courts just decided to fight back. And they were armed in part with the fact that the Survey LA survey, where the city and the Getty went out and made note of historically significant, but not necessarily landmarked structures in a lot of neighborhoods. They didn't get everything. Obviously, in Cheviot Hills, they missed... yeah, well, we won't go into that. Ray Bradbury House. There's a whole podcast about that. But in this case, they did get these bungalows on Edinburgh. They said they were significant. They were important early 1920s residential buildings. And so with that, they were able to get the support of their councilman and also of the LA Conservancy and began trying to landmark the building, even though they were all being evicted. They were being Ellis'd out. The Ellis Act is when a landlord says, I want to get out of the rental business and evict everyone in their rent-controlled units and then knock them down or turn them into condos or build something else on the site. So even though everybody had been evicted and lost their homes, they continued to fight. It took a couple of hearings, but darned if the thing wasn't landmarked. And now that it is, the landlord, who had been arguing, we've restored a lot of historic buildings and these buildings, having looked at them, there's been so much deferred maintenance, the termites have destroyed them, these are unsafe for anyone to live in. People who live there said, we love it here, leave us alone. They said, no, the only way we can make this safe so we won't be sued is if we lift them up and build a new foundation, which we cannot do because of how they were built. And the people said, just leave us alone and let us stay in our homes, they're fine. Well, now that it's landmarked, magically, the landlords of this now vacant structure no longer wish to Ellis, because it's really, really hard. They're looking for someone to buy the buildings. So those bungalow courts, it'll be really interesting to see what happens. I don't know if rent control remains in effect when everyone's been evicted on the grounds of Ellis and then that doesn't happen. It's
still long prey.
Right, but I don't, when, same thing happened with Charles Bukowski's former bungalow in East Hollywood, which we were involved with in 2007. I don't know what the rents were when people moved back in. It's curious, but happily, this really lovely structure survives, and you can go down and see it down on Edinburgh, or you can do what I did this morning, do the Google Maps image street view, and then click through the various years, because they've taken pictures of it about five times, in 2007, 2008, 2009, it's beautiful, and then as of last fall, it's just this disgusting empty hulk. Well, one day soon, it'll be a home again. Hooray.
Thank you, Kim. Coming to the end here, the 1937 Gilbert Stanley Underwood Federal Court Building at Temple and Spring is going to be given over to the state court system, which I'm very happy. I'm sorry for Ken Bernstein and Ken and Lambert and all of our other friends of the Office of Historic Resources. I know that there was some sort of suggestion that the city would get to take over the building and all the cool kids in City Hall would get to move there. And
but maybe they can all move into Parker Center. You know, there's a lot of cool buildings in downtown LA that might be available. But yeah, it would have been nice to be able to go to the Office of Historic Resources in the courthouse. Now we'll have to wait until we see someone.
That wasn't funny, Kim. So we're going to, Kim, we still have some lists, items on this list. So we have to work through them. I'm going to take one, and then you're going to take one. Okay. So we have two blog posts out in the last couple of weeks about three-dimensional scans with our good friend Craig. Craig Sauer, yes. Craig Sauer is a photographer. He does a lot of commercial work in real estate, and he needs to go photograph the Lafayette. It's called Jack, speaking of Long Beach murals. We get Craig into spaces, and he takes scans of them. One of the scans we did just this week was the Dutch Chocolate Shop. And Kim, about a month ago, 3 weeks ago, we did a scan of JK's Tunnel. So why don't you just talk about this in general, this process?
Yeah, so these are really cool tools. They're Matterport is the name of the technology, and it's a three-dimensional scan. You take a multitude of pictures using a tablet that's on a tripod, and then the computer stitches them all together, and what you end up with is a zoomable, scannable, three-dimensional space that you can walk through, sort of like in a video game, but it's a cool historic site in this case. So the first one that we did was sort of an outlier, a place we'd never been before. Susan Phillips, who's our graffiti scholar friend, told us about this particular drainage tunnel near the LA River, near the rail yards, which was inscribed, actually carved with words by a probably schizophrenic nameless hobo known only as J.K. and circa 1940. And so we know it's circa 1940 by various things that he says and by the fact that apparently he liked Lana Turner because one of the things he carved into the concrete was Lana's name. And so we went in there and Craig was able to capture this space, and it's a space, you know, not a lot of people have been into, and a space that when you're there, surrounded by garbage and the roar of trains and graffiti that has gone over on top of JK's work, it's kind of hard to take in everything you're seeing. So with what Craig did, we were able to actually go through the text that JK inscribed and learn more about it. And then the second one that we did is the Dutch chocolate shop, the Ernest Batchelder tiled space, which is one of the most popular historic locations that we've ever had the opportunity to take people into in downtown Los Angeles, which is currently closed to the public. So it's really nice to be able to make that three-dimensional scan available so people can enjoy it while it awaits its future transformation, which is coming soon, and we'll let you know about it as soon as we can.
Good job. Thank you, Craig. Craig's great. Thank you, Craig. And there are more locations in the queue, so stay tuned. I won't give them away. Okay, Kim, best for last, Pershing Square Renew.
Oh, at the end of the month, we would love you to join us.
Date? What date?
28th of April. And if you go to lavatransforms.org, you'll find the event. They're finally releasing the four proposed designs for the new Pershing Square. And we're really curious to see if one or more of the chosen architect and landscape designer firms have taken to heart the proposal that we've been pushing for so long and with so much support from the public, that rather than completely remaking Pershing Square yet again, John Parkinson's beautiful 1910 design, which was the only successful design the park has ever had and which was lost starting in 1952 when the parking garage went in, and then over time more and more of it was carved away. The idea that maybe they would look to John Parkinson's axial plan with the fountain in the center and the benches and the paths and the shade trees, etc. All I can tell you is that we do know that people in the Pershing Square Renew office have been told by all of these designers, we are aware of the desire from some people that it be restored. So we'll go down. It's a big free event. Was at the LA Theater, now it's at the Palace. And there's going to be, I guess, food and drink. And they'll show what they've got, and people will have the opportunity to give some feedback. And I hope people who are interested in the future of Pershing Square will come down and make their points heard. And, you know, it's a giant question mark. It always has been. But we care about this place a lot, and I think it's important that people who love what Pershing Square could be part of this process moving forward. And who knows? Maybe they'll actually find some money and be able to do something with the park. I'm curious to see.
So, you know, I want to just, we've been down this road a long time, and I just, you know, as I sit here, I want everyone to know I don't put my pork pie hat on and my removable collar when I say restore the park. You know, I say restore Pershing Square because it embodies all the principles of positive public space. Okay, I'm not getting caught up on limestone carvings which could not be duplicated today for less than $1 million a square foot. Okay, because no one knows how to do that stuff anymore. We're talking, right, Kim? We're talking about bringing back a positive public space where people can sit in the shade and eat their lunch. And yeah. And I just, you know, like we go to these meetings and everyone just acts like I'm wearing a pork pie hat with a detachable collar, and like I want it to be 1920, and that I'm being racist.
Oh, Christopher Hawthorne said it was racist of us to be pushing for that 1910 design because the 1910 design was about whitewashing Spanish Los Angeles. Gee, I don't know. I thought Central Park, which later became Pershing Square, was about having a second plaza.
Okay, so just thank you. Okay, that's it. We're done with closely watched trains. We have some upcoming events we have to get through.
Oh, let me go.
Yes. So, Kim, we've got some upcoming events we're very proud of. Don't forget my walking tour.
I won't, but do you want me to...
Because I just ordered my new backpack for the walking tour. Not the one we talked about. A different one.
Okay.
Much better, less expensive. You're like, it's very utilitarian.
I was kind of excited about your Tyrolean backpack, but okay.
We'll baby steps.
Okay, baby. Yes, it's true, and this is by popular demand. For us as well as you, the Lava Sunday Salon, our free cultural history lecture series in downtown Los Angeles, is back. It is not easy to find a venue where 60-plus people can come have something to eat and quietly sit and listen to a talk where you don't have to pay for the space. And unfortunately, our venues have kept closing as downtown has gentrified, and it's been harder and harder to keep these wonderful big spaces open. But we are back, and in such a terrific historic location, 99 years old this year, Grand Central Market. The basement, yes. If you've ever gone to the bathroom at Grand Central Market, you know what we're talking about. If you've ever gone to that little 99-cent store, there's that little sitting area between the bathrooms and the discount store. And we're going to get a projector down there and a PA, and that is where the salon's going to be. We're going to start with Nathan Marsak, Lava Visionary of the Year for 2015. But since we haven't been doing salons, he gets a carryover a little bit. And why wouldn't we want him to? Scholar of Old Bunker Hill. He's going to talk about lost downtown architecture. He's going to show some wonderful film clips of Angel's Flight and just get us into the spirit of what was and what still is in downtown. And then we're going to go out and have a free walking tour with Nathan and Richard of Hill Street, starting, of course.
And Gordon.
Oh, Gordon?
Gordon Patterson,
the native son of Bunker Hill, starting, of course, with Angel's Flight Railway, which is still not running, but hopefully we'll be soon, and just some terrific buildings, Art Deco and otherwise. Both of these events are free, but reservations are required, and they're filling up already. Word is out, so go to lavatransforms.org, get on those mailing lists, sign up for those two events. We would love to see you there. And it's really means a lot to us to be able to bring this event back, being able to bring the community together for free events is a big part of what we do. And you know, we want you to get on the bus, but not everyone can get on the bus, and more people can get together at these salons and walking tours, which we love. The other thing that I would be remiss not to mention is that also under the umbrella of LAVA, we do quarterly forensic science seminars, which are fundraisers for the criminalistics graduate students at Cal State Los Angeles who go on to become forensic scientists for the LAPD and the Sheriff's Department. So if you would like to help them with their research and get a full afternoon of really grisly, revealing true crime investigation and courtroom antics, you want to join us at the crime lab, which is called Murder Will Out, The Secret World of Trace Evidence. It's on April 17th. It, too, is filling up. And again, lavatransforms.org. Yes, Lynn Harold has put together a wonderful program based on one of the more interesting cases that she did the forensic science for. I could go on, but we need to get into the show, so just go to LAVA if you're interested in forensic science. You can sign up for the LAVA newsletter and stay informed about these forensic science events, the upcoming LAVA Sunday salons and walking tours, and again, if I didn't say so, begins in May for those LAVA salons and walking tours, May 29, last Sunday of the month. See you there.
Great, thank you. Okay, let's get to the task at hand, which is introducing the people we're going to interview. So Gail is going to be our second interview, so I will introduce her first. Okay, Gail. She's a curator. She's a curator at the Palos Verdes Arts Center. She is passionate about mid-century architecture. That's why the exhibit is there. The exhibit runs through May 29th. The Art Center is open every day of the week. The Art Center was designed in 1974 by Victor Grün. It was a big, big architect. Yeah. Great building. Okay, the four featured architects. Well, we'll get into this, but the featured architects are Neutra, Koning, Williams, and Jones. A. Quincy Jones, Paul Revere Williams, Pierre Koning, and Richard Neutra. They're all great. It's a great show. She goes through everything. It's a rock solid interview. We cover all the bases. I need to introduce. That's mid-century modern is a very well understood phenomenon. Roger, a.k.a. Waldo, is not a very well-understood phenomenon, and one of my favorite people who is very enigmatic and needs a little elaboration, so you can just sort of get your head around him. Okay, first of all, we're going to interview Roger first. Roger has a new book, American Saloons, Pre-Prohibition Photographs. He has a website, historicsaloonphotographs.com. It's on the webpage for this podcast. Go buy it through the website. I built a Shopify site for him, okay? Make him believe me that this is a good idea, because it is. 15 years ago, he put out a book, Saloons, Bars, Cigar Stores. Okay, it's out of print. You'll never find it. So Roger is obviously obsessed with saloons. He opened the Handlebar Saloon in December of 1970. He sold it in 1986. The Handlebar Saloon is on this little alley, Rhodes Alley, behind the Academy Theater, off of Colorado, just east of Lake. It's now T-Boyle's, I think, is the bar that's there now. But anyway, it's this great atmosphere. Pure Waldo. Pure Waldo. He also, in 1990, he opened The Right Spot, which is at Colorado and Fair Oaks. And he'll talk about this. He commissioned Kenton Nelson to do this mural. And the mural is this really it's great. City Hell. 800-degree pizza parlor took over the space about 3 years ago, 2 years ago. And of course, they had our friend, the stonemason, Frank Gallagher, restore the mural, working with Kenton, but Frank was involved in actually taking down the it was great.
Well, I mean, what you're not saying, of course, is that this mural is pure Waldo too, because he was just in the shadow of Pasadena City Hall and was having such a pain in the neck dealing with all of their permits because he doesn't like to be told what to do. So he just commissioned a mural in which he denigrated everyone in City Hall as corrupt nincompoops and featured himself and all of his friends in this beautiful WPA style, which Kenton Nelson is so equipped at. And it's just a wonderful piece, and so glad that it's come back.
And so what I need you to do is I need you to tell people real-life person is portrayed as Uncle Sam in the mural. Paul Rogers.
Oh, I thought so, yeah. So Paul Rogers, who is Kenton Nelson's dear friend from art school.
And design.
And the illustrator who did my Raymond Chandler-themed mystery novel, The Kept Girl, and then...
And did the artwork for...
Yes, Richard. And then he got the commission to do the new Raymond Chandler map for Herb Lester, so he did the art. I know, darling. He did the artwork of the Chandler map, and I wrote it, and then he's become this great proponent of Saving Angels Flight, which is one of our preservation campaigns, so we get to work with him a lot, and sure enough, yes, he is Uncle Sam, but he's got his back turned to you, so you'd have to be told this to know it, but now you know.
Roger lives in the old Lukens house. Okay, this is a famous house. We'll put the Wikipedia page link on the website. So this is kind of interesting. So, this is interesting in and of itself, not about Waldo. Theodore Lukens, really interesting guy, early mayor in Pasadena, early forester, believed correctly that you could reforest the San Gabriel Mountains and protect the watersheds after fires. Pilot programs are the paradigms under now which the National Forest Service works. Okay, what's interesting is that Mr. Lukens' house was designed by Harry Ridgway. Harry Ridgway also built the original Santa Fe Depot. Okay, this is the depot that was built for the Raymond Hotel in South Pasadena. Lukens was left his second term of mayor after like 9 months because he got into this big fight with the Southern Pacific Railroad. And he said, no, I don't want to grant this exclusive right to the Southern Pacific because we already have a train station, which was designed by the same man that built his house. And so, I'm not impugning his quest, but it's interesting that someone he worked with a lot also, he lost his position over this train station, which was designed by the man that also built his house. And it's just these little things, the little things. And, of course, the train station is now basically where the Del Mar Pasadena light rail station is. So, and, of course, that was torn down in the 20s for a new Spanish colonial revival station, the Ridgway. And also Ridgway did the original public library in Pasadena, which is now in the park next to City Hall. And that library was also decommissioned for the Myron Hunt 1927 Spanish colonial revival main library.
And mostly you're talking about demolished buildings. So the fact that Waldo is still sitting on Lukens' house, sitting in Lukens' house, which is National Register, one of the last of the great early Pasadena mansions. It's an extraordinary thing. I mean, the 210 freeway couldn't be a whole lot closer, and there are apartments nearby and churches and so forth, and yet this delightful house still abides. And inside, dare I call him the real-life Gomez Adams? Yes, I will.
Let's take it away with our interview with Roger. Roger, I'm here with you. We're at your beautiful Victorian house in Pasadena, which I'm a huge fan of. I would like for you to properly introduce yourself, your full name, and we'll get started on the topic of our interview, which is your new book.
Roger Evan Kislingberry. Same thing I give the police when they arrest me. My book is called American Saloons, Pre-Prohibition Photographs. It's the second book I've done. The first one was called Saloons, Bars, Cigar Stores, which I did 15 years ago, and it sold out. So I've created another one, a companion copy, and it's an eye full of pre-Prohibition Americana saloons.
Perfect. Okay, there are a couple threads we're going to follow to get to you having published this book, which is, I love this book, very excited. The first is, why don't we start with your first inclinations, motivations, fascinations with saloons, which goes back to your childhood.
Well, my first exposure to saloons was via the television, probably late 40s. My folks picked up an RCA television, which was, of course, black and white back in those days. And most television programming, they showed a lot of old movies. There wasn't many programs on at that time. And Westerns were predominant, and I just gravitated towards the early Westerns, and especially when the camera rolled into an old saloon, and there was the bar and these early gambling machines that I had no idea how they worked, but they looked great, and taxidermy and the old back bar, and I just was fascinated. So that kind of started me off on my quest for saloon memorabilia and photographs relating to such.
Perfect. And just a couple of locations visited as a child locally, the Pony Express Museum and Knott's. You just want to delve into those quickly?
Yeah, my first real exposure to a, quote, ghost town, unquote, was I was a small kid. My folks took me to Knott's Berry Farm way back before it was an amusement park, and Walter Knott had recreated a wonderful ghost town. There were a couple of saloons in there, and oh boy, I had to go and look at those. And then subsequential to that, my folks took me out to Parker Lyon collections called the Pony Express Museum in Arcadia. And that was a very popular tourist attraction in the 40s and very early 50s. And they had bars in there and trains and just everything Western and old Americana. And that ruined my day. It sent me off. Yeah.
Okay, before, there's still a lot more to talk about. Let's specifically talk about the book, though, before we get lost in the motive, the passion and obsessions that drove you to make your second book. Tell us a little bit about this book. You know, it's a picture book, you know, yeah.
This book is a compilation of photographs that I've acquired over the last 20 years. Pre-Prohibition photographs, real photo postcards, and actual cabinet views photographs of interiors and exteriors of American saloons. And a lot of them show the elements that so much, you know, intrigued me as a young child. There's slot machines, the taxidermy, of course, advertising, leaded glass, beautiful back bars, and, of course, all the characters that were also in the saloon at the time. And I thought it would be wonderful to share those photographs with the public and fans, of course, and hopefully create new fans. So thus this book, and it's been a hard work, but I think it's paid off.
Okay, I know we're gonna, on the website, we're going to have all the contact information we need for people to get in touch with you. Give us a price, and also okay. That I think it's just contacting you via mail at this point. It's not, is it, if it, let us know if it'll
be PayPal, but I hate PayPal because I got to pay them a commission.
No. So if people want to order the book, they can email you. And is it going to be at Vroman's? Any local bookshops? Any plans for that? It's okay to say no. We have problems stocking.
Not at this time.
Yeah.
Right now, I'm just directly selling them as author publisher, and the book is hardbound. It's 340 some pages, embossed cover, and it retails at $65, and shipping and handling is $650.
And you've got this great cardboard box that you ship it in, by the way, which Kim and I are very impressed by.
Yeah, the box is actually better than the book. You just throw the book away and keep the box.
No, I meant for shipping. This isn't good. Yeah. You're pointing something to me,
that's
Kim.
That's me as a child.
Oh,
I did a salute in my bedroom back in 1960. That's me.
Okay, so describe. We're looking at a photo of you at 16. Describe this photo.
I built a saloon in my bedroom as a child and had artifacts hanging on the wall, and I hammed up a picture. A buddy of mine was a photographer with a local newspaper at the school, and he took a shot of me, and there I am, a profile of yours truly, hamming it up with a cigar box.
Good. Okay, let's start to look at, let's start to jump into your adult years, your career as an entrepreneur, and a restorer of gambling equipment. Let's start with the gambling equipment, because you're sitting next to one right now. It's pretty impressive. Tell us about you restore these. This is a great career, passion, hobby, exactly. Vocation, everything.
Correct. Yes. Oh, I've been a collector and a restorer of early gambling machines and early penny arcade machines. We're looking at pre-1920 cast iron and oak machines, floor model slot machines. And I do a lot of work for collectors all over the country. I get the plating, they do the cabinet work, the mechanism, the foundry work.
Let's actually walk through that quickly, if you don't mind, because people love this. So you're up in Grass Valley, and you walk into a secondhand shop, and somehow you manage to find a machine, which I guess could happen. You bring it back here. What do you do with an old machine that doesn't work?
Well, generally, I can get anything working, or I can get the parts made. But right. Today, you don't just find them anymore in an antique store. Today's market is usually at auctions,
okay.
And other collectors dealing with each other. But I used to go on the road to Colorado back in the early 70s and hit old towns and find operators of jukeboxes and ask who had coin-op. And they said, oh, we used to run slot machines back in the 40s. Next thing you know, over in a guy's garage, and there's some stuff. Those were glory days, finding that stuff from the original operator or from the original family. That was always a thrill. The hunt was greater than the actually, you know, bagging the prey.
And in these trips, I imagine you also found fixtures from 19th century saloons.
Oh yeah, a lot of times I'd be in towns and there'd be bars that were there or parts of them were there, but there's fixtures in the basement. There'd be leaded glass or a pair of saloon doors. And items that were in the old bar, and I love it because it was never thrown out. A lot of these guys just kept the stuff, especially in small mining towns, that people just kept the stuff.
Kim and I were recently in Southeast Missouri, in St. Genevieve, Missouri, and we were at a saloon that had a bar taken off a steamer ship in 1853 that had run aground off the right there at the dock. It was a thing of beauty.
Oh yeah, it's always fun to find something that's been put away or stored away for years, and you're the first guy to get his hands on it from a collector's end.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Let's also quickly talk about these the peep shows,
Well, there's a company called Mutoscope that made the first motion picture, quote unquote. It was flip cards, and they were a sequence of stills that gave you a sense of motion. Those came out in 1898. They were a cast iron machine, and then later machines were a drop picture, which were stereoptic in views, mm-hmm. and there'd be 12 views, and Mills Novelty and Cayley Brothers Detroit made them, and they were popular in bars because a lot of them showed risque pictures, and they were also in penny arcades at the time.
Right.
So those are very collectible today for people interested in coin operation machines.
Okay, so let's jump into, we've talked a bit about you as a collector, you as a restorer, a machinist, and a craftsman for restoring these are beautiful machines, just gorgeous. Let's talk about you as an entrepreneur. In Pasadena, starting in the 70s, you've opened a number of bars throughout the decades, and if you could just sort of walk us through that, because I think this maps very nicely to your passion for pre-prohibition saloons.
Yeah, I basically had my passion, work as a mode of income. My first bar I built with a couple of partners was called the Handlebar Saloon, and I knew of an old back bar up in Lovelock, Nevada, and we dragged it down to Pasadena and opened up a beer joint and ran that for 15 years. And then the subsequent...
Dates on that, if you don't mind, just roughly?
It was 1970 we opened, December 1970.
Perfect.
And then a couple years later, we bought a building in Santa Ana and did another saloon there called Handlebar Santa Ana Saloon. I had a back bar I got out of Denver I put into there. And then in the 80s, we built a place called DeLacy's Club 41 in Pasadena. Mm-hmm. And uh, I put a beautiful Brunswick 24-foot, it's called the Del Monte model bar in there. And the bar is still there to this day. I sold my interest in the restaurant and got out of the lease, but I still own the bar and leased that to the present tenant. So it's still paying me. And that bar came out of Toledo, Ohio. I remember the day I got it, it was snowing, and I went and saw it, and I bought it. My partner thought I was nuts. It's paid 10 times back what I paid for it in rent.
God bless you.
Yeah. Capitalism does occasionally pay off.
It does. You've had other ventures, the Right Spot and the mural that our friend Kenton did, just while we're on the topic of your career.
Yeah. I did a bar. I went modern, and we did a deco interior called a bar called the, it was a restaurant bar called the Right Spot, and the bar room was called the Mecca Room. And a good friend of mine, R. Kenton Nelson, I commissioned him to do the mural on the wall, a little political tongue in cheek humor in it. So that was another venture. But it was modern. It was out of the 20s and 30s. I consider that new.
Right. And it's that mural has just been restored. Frank Gallagher went down with Kenton and spent a couple days with him, and it's now called 800 Celsius Pizza Parlor.
Yeah, the only regret is I didn't put it on panels and take it out when I sold the place.
Okay. Why?
I do. I regret that.
Okay, well, next time. Why don't you tell us your favorite you've mentioned several places this interview, great emotional moments when you found things, but just, you know, one great story about finding an old part of a saloon that's just really
about a machine.
Yeah.
One of the great stories is I was in Wyoming with my partner. We were heading back from back east, heading home, and it was snowing, and we were out of Rock Springs, Wyoming, and the truck broke down, and we hitchhiked into town, had the truck towed in, and the next day we had the truck over at the shop getting repaired, and I'm just walking around the town, and there was a building getting torn down, and I had photographs in my pocket I always keep of slot machines, an early floor model, and I showed it to one of the workers, and he goes, I know what is one of those things, up in Hudson, Wyoming, in Red Spiller's Bar. So when the truck got repaired, we drove the next day 60 miles to Hudson, and to make a long story short, I went into the bar, and it was operating, and the machine wasn't there, but I snuck in the basement, and there was a very rare Cayley double slot machine that today's worth about $150,000, and we bought that and took it to auction and sold it a few months later at an auction in Las Vegas. But that was a great lead, just finding out that the truck hadn't broken down, we never would have found the machine.
Right.
You know, that was one of my favorite stories.
Perfect. Okay, let's bring this on home. Please remind people the name of your book and that they can reach out to you to find it. We'll put your email and phone number on the website, and let's just remind them about the book, and we'll bring this on home.
Yes, the book is called American Saloons Pre-Prohibition Photographs, hardbound. It's about 10 by 12. There's over 200 photographs. It's well worth looking at, and if you have any interest at all in old bars, you will be excited, and if you don't, you definitely will be excited after you see it.
Roger, thank you so much. You are a treasure to Pasadena and Southern California.
Just
thank
don't
you.
Bury me.
God bless you.
Thank you.
Hello, my name is Albert Okura. I'm here in San Bernardino, California, right on Route 66, and you're listening to You Can't Eat the Sunshine.
Gail, we're here. Tell us where we are and what we're doing here.
Well, we're at the Palos Verdes Art Center, and we are in an exhibition called Palos Verdes Modern, which is celebrating mid-century modern architecture on the Palos Verdes Peninsula.
We're talking to you because?
Because I am one of the co-curators, and I am also the education director at the Palos Verdes Art Center, and I am passionate about mid-century modern architecture.
Perfect. Okay. This exhibit, give us the runtime for the exhibit so everyone knows they have time to come down.
The show is open 7 days a week. The galleries are open Monday through Friday, 9 to 5, Saturday, 9 to 4, and Sunday, 1 to 4. And admission is always free.
And this show runs through May?
The show runs through May 29th.
Okay, we're going to air this in the next couple weeks, so people will have a good lead time. Okay, we're going to start. We're going to start with the title, Palos Verdes Modern. What does that mean?
Well, we wanted to talk about this really special period of time in the growth of the Palos Verdes Peninsula. Everybody knows that Palos Verdes Estates was founded in 1931, which was coincidentally the same year that the Palos Verdes Art Center was founded as the cultural arm of the peninsula. But the peninsula remained basically static in terms of its population until the 1950s. And then the post-war growth of the aerospace industry contributed to an enormous population growth because engineers were brought in from the East Coast with their families. They were looking for places to live that were clean, that were safe. And Palos Verdes was a terrific location.
I'm going to interrupt you just to give us a little more grounding in the geography. Lakewood Avenue, Rosemead Boulevard, is basically was an aerospace artery that ran from Los Angeles, central downtown Los Angeles, down out of San Gabriel Valley, down into the peninsula. So the peninsula was a natural place for these engineers to go. Boeing, Northrop, the space plant. Yeah, so these are all a straight shot due north of here.
Right. I understand that in its early days, the peninsula was called the Hughes Ghetto. But it was basically an opportunity for people to bring their families here. There was a lot of affordable housing, a lot of development that was happening during that period of time. And also with that development came civic buildings, libraries were built, schools were built. The Palos Verdes Art Center actually was established in its permanent location in 1974. Victor Gruen, the famous developer of the mall, the shopping mall, designed Peninsula Center. So there was a great deal of sort of cutting-edge architecture that was happening here on the peninsula. And this exhibit really showcases the top four architects of the period. So can we take a look at some of the pieces?
Okay, so before we take a look at the pieces, you're going to tell us the top four architects.
Okay, so the show focuses on Richard Neutra, Pierre Koenig, A. Quincy Jones, and Paul Revere Williams.
Perfect. Okay, and now, here we go. We're standing in front of some beautiful drawings, and I assume some nice Julia Schumann photos.
Actually, I'm not sure about the photographs, but the drawings are very interesting. This is a representation of the Beckstrand House. The Beckstrand House was actually started in 1937 and completed in 1940. And it was the very first project on the peninsula by the esteemed architect Richard Neutra. And this was actually even before he went on to become a case study architect. But the Beckstrands, who commissioned him, were very cosmopolitan, and Mildred Beckstrand actually had a brother who was an art dealer in New York, and she was a great patron of the arts in Palos Verdes. In fact, she donated a great deal of money to the Palos Verdes Art Center, and there was a gallery, an exhibition gallery, named after her. So when they decided to build their home on the Palos Verdes Peninsula, they wanted the most cutting edge, the most contemporary design, so they reached out to Richard Neutra.
Fantastic. This is a beautiful house. You talked about civic buildings, and I'd like to just touch on that just a little bit more, because civic buildings are easy for people to go into when they come down here. So could we just get a couple more. Let's.
We can actually look at a school designed yes. by Richard Neutra.
Okay, so here we are at this table. What do we look? Let's go around. Okay, we got ourselves oriented here. What are we looking at here?
Here we are. So much later, in 1959, it was determined that the peninsula, now that it was fully expanding, it needed another high school. So Richard Neutra was commissioned to do the design, and at that time he was partnering with Robert Alexander.
Famous partnership.
Yes, a very famous partnership. So, you know, he had grown enormously as an architect, and his reputation was very big. And it was actually one of his largest commissions, because the property that the high school is built on, I believe, is something like 35 acres. And it was prime real estate, ocean views. In fact, its proximity to the ocean posed some interesting engineering problems, because he had to account for all of the wind that came up from the water in his design. Now, the Homes Association, the Palos Verdes Homes Association, had some very rigid constraints in terms of the buildings that could be built here and some of the elements that they needed to possess. And the art jury was very partial to these sort of Spanish-style pieces of architecture, and Richard Neutra was a modernist. So he did manage to be compliant, and he did cover his building with stucco, but he very slyly put wonderful sort of details that were very mid-century modern, like these spider legs that come out of the roof line. Yeah. They look like they're just utilitarian, because they do hold up this cantilevered overhang for the students to walk under, but they're also a highly decorative feature. So he became very adept at getting around the regulations of the art jury. I believe that he did at least a dozen residential and civic projects here on the Palos Verdes Arts Center. And there's one that I would really like to show you that's very interesting. We mentioned the Beckstrand House earlier, and the drawings that are represented in the show are actually the drawings that were presented to the art jury. And you'll notice that the roof line is highlighted in those drawings with marker. The reason for that is the art jury specified that he had to have a sloped roof and that the roof had to have red tile. Now again, here is someone coming out of the international style tradition, flat roof, certainly no red tile. But the jury didn't specify the degree of slope. So Richard Neutra very slyly minimized the degree of slope, and then he built a very wide parapet in front of the roof. So when you look at the house from street level, you cannot see the roof, but he did manage to get it through the art jury.
Fantastic.
Now here's another property that he also built. This is in Rolling Hills, and he built it for Dr. Coe and his family.
I'm gonna interrupt you. Just a word on geography, perhaps. Palos Verdes Estates, most of the tracks are down near the ocean, and Rolling Hills is higher up towards the top of the peninsula.
That's correct. It's actually a gated community, but they were still subject to the Palos Verdes Homes Association art jury. So when the Coe House was built, which I believe was in 1950, by now Richard Neutra was very well known because of the case study homes project. And he also came up against some issues with the art jury. Namely, he decided to put redwood paneling on the outside of the home. And this was, of course, a decorative feature. But the art jury insisted that the house be painted all white in compliance with the sort of equestrian look of the neighborhood. So Richard Neutra wrote a scathing indictment, of the Palos Verdes Homes Association in an article called Restricted Architecture. And he published the article in Arts and Architecture, which was the preeminent architecture magazine and the same magazine that sponsored the case study homes project. So he got his point across. The homeowners did, in fact, have to paint the house, but many years later, they relented and they were able to strip it down and bring it back to its original redwood siding.
I love it. You did it. It was fantastic. You did it. This is. Tell us about once as on our way out. Tell us about the exhibit again, and so people can come down.
Yeah, we would love you to come down. It's Palos Verdes Modern. Again, it's a celebration of mid-century modern art and design. In conjunction with this exhibition, we also have a wonderful show called Crafted that will be up until April 24th, and that features architectural pottery, which are beautiful vessels that were also designed in the 1960s as complements to the architectural design, and also fantastic rugs that are provided courtesy of Amati Carpets. So come on down.
Thank you very much, Gail.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Richard's mom, and I'm at Nate Nell's with Kim and Richard, and you're listening to You Can't Eat the Sunshine. Finish your soup, Richard.
And we're done. I'd like to thank everyone for listening to our latest podcast, You Can't Eat the Sunshine, for the week of April 4th, 2016. Our guests this week were Roger Evans Kislingbury, a.k.a. Waldo. We talked to him about his new book, American Saloons, Pre-Prohibition Photographs, and Gail Finney. She is co-curator at the Palos Verdes Art Center, and we talked to her about their new show, Palos Verdes Modernism, which is there through the end of May. We like to hear from you. We like feedback. So Kim, please tell us about the feedback loop.
It's a big old feedback loop, and it mainly includes you sending us an email. You can go to youcanteatthesunshine@gmail.com or go through the contact link at www.esotwork.com. If you're so inclined and you listen to the show on iTunes, you can leave a review there. And it always helps when people do leave reviews, because if you're a podcast listener, people who listen to the shows you listen to might see ours as a recommendation. So if you're digging what we do and you'd like to give some feedback, we would be grateful for it. And if not, hi there in Radioland.
Perfect. Okay, Kim, we did it. That's another of our now monthly podcast series in the can. We're in the home stretch. I need you to take us home with some upcoming bus tours.
Yeah, let me add them. I can do this quick and I can do it easy, because I know these tours like the back of my hand. April 9th. It's Pasadena Confidential, a crime bus tour about rocket science, black magic, sex magic, inappropriate pets, millionaires, presidential assassins, and so forth. And don't forget your hammer murderers. Yeah, new on this tour, we'll be talking a little bit about the famous Los Feliz murder mansion, finally on the market after 59 years or so. 56. We'll be talking about a possible connection to a Pasadena hammer murder that might explain what happened in that Los Feliz mystery house. And, of course, we will go to Waldo's house. So if you've listened to this podcast and Waldo has piqued your interest, you can peek through the fence and wave at him behind the windows. Also, coming up is our most popular crime bus tour on April 16th. It's The Real Black Dahlia, the tour that asks not who killed Bess Short, but who was she and why all these years after her still unsolved 1947 murder in some part of Los Angeles. She ended up bisected in the Leimert Park District, probably was kidnapped from downtown. Why, all these years later, should we care? It is a really powerful tour, and it's, of course, filling up. It is our most popular. We'd love to see you there. Echo Park Book of the Dead is a new crime bus tour. That's April the 23rd, and it's a tour about offbeat history, architecture, and murder in some of the loveliest neighborhoods in the Southland. And we'll take a little stroll through the Victorians in Angelino Heights. We'll go see Sister Amy Simple McPherson's House Museum. Oh, it'll be a hoot. We'd love to see you on that one, too. In fact, we'd love to see you on any old bus tour. Like, for instance, April 30th, Haunts of a Dirty Old Man, the Charles Bukowski tour. where, yes, we will go to a bungalow court apartment, and it's the one we helped to save when landlords, just before the last big bubble crash, tried to evict everybody and knock it down and build a condo. And darned if that didn't work, because it's now a historic cultural landmark, and lots of happy people live there, too. And we'll follow in the footsteps of Bukowski, and how he remade himself is what we will look at. How a 50-year-old, newly retired, early retiree, postal employee became an internationally acclaimed novelist and poet. It's quite a story. East Side Babylon gets us back in the crime bus tip, and that is Saturday, May 7th. It is my most unhinged crime bus tour. Some really dark stories and some really neat buildings, like, for instance, the Giant Tamale in East L.A., and some of the toughest crimes that I've ever researched. So if you want to go out on the East Side and really get your mind blown and end up with a lovely walk through Evergreen Cemetery to see the Carneys and a stop on Hubbard Street to see where Richard Ramirez, the serial killer, met his match with a very angry neighborhood, get on that bus. On May the 13th is my sister's birthday. May the 14th is Raymond Chandler's Los Angeles, a noir journey through 1920s downtown and 1940s Hollywood in pursuit of the real Raymond Chandler, the author, and Philip Marlowe, his alter ego, and some really interesting bits of Chandleriana that we've uncovered in our years doing this tour, including his completely unknown, until I made an incredible discovery, failed career as an author of light operetta in the 1910s. And wrapping up this list, but not our calendar, there are more to come, is our once-a-year tour, Crawling Down Cahuenga, Tom Waits, L.A. It is on May the 21st. It is a special event.
I like that tour.
And once a year, my longtime collaborator, David Smay, who I did two anthologies of rock and roll criticism with back in the dark ages before I hung out with you, Richard, David Smay comes down from San Francisco, and we do a bus tour based on his book on Tom Waits' album, Swordfish Trombones, which is sort of the last of his L.A. albums and a very transformative one for his life and work. And so we go through downtown, Echo Park, Hollywood, West Hollywood, in the footsteps of Tom Waits. David's a terrific tour guide for someone who only does it once a year, my goodness. And it's really neat to get all the Tom Waits people together on the bus. So
I'm gonna interrupt you. Do you know the secret to David Smay being a really good tour guide, besides the fact that he's incredibly gifted? He's effusive about the work you and I do.
I always do blush on the bus. He says such nice things. And we're happy that we're able to give him a spotlight because, as Richard says, he's an extraordinarily gifted cultural critic. And it's a really swell book. His 33 and a third book on Swordfish Trombones is available. We don't sell them on the bus because it's just kind of a headache to order books. So if you want to get an autographed copy, order it ahead of time. It's like $10. Bring it with you and David will sign it. That's May the 21st. And that is plenty of bus tours. It should be something in there for you. So we'll see you aboard.
Thank you. Thank you, Kim. Thank you again. Thank you, everyone at home, for listening. I want to encourage you to continue to listen, and I want to remind you,
you can't eat the sunshine.
You can't eat the sunshine, but you can make a beeline for the best of the coastline. La, 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 la. Skid Row, Solano Canyon, the Doria, and Pico Union, the long-lost neighborhood called Hermina, between South Pass and Highland Park, Grand Central Park. It is divine. You can't eat the sunshine, but it's a gold mine.